even had a few fingers in Venezuela, Bolivia, and, of course, Mexico. What about Lockhart? He was the one in state and even served on a few influential Pentagon policy panels. But then he jumped ship and started working for a Texas-based corporate intelligence agency called the Boggs Institute that bills itself as a shadow CIA, which to me sounds like shadow bullshit. They engaged him as a chief geopolitical strategist, and I guess he was quite an asset for them, with little old clients like the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the Marines. My Marines? Your Marines? I thought you'd enjoy that. Anyway, it was all milk and honey until those intelligence leaks a few years back, when the Boggs Institute was exposed as just a bunch of money-grubbing assholes. She read from one of the sheets. With a geographical determinism that a lot of people mistook for predictive powers. What Henry Kissinger used to refer to as geopolitics. She nodded as she continued reading. The supposed amoral, dispassionate concern with national interests like mineral and energy access. What happened to this marriage made in hell? Some of Lockhart's emails got leaked. A bunch of connections to a lot of CEOs of some really big corporations. I thought about it. Seems like that would just add to his worth. Not these leaked emails, which also included handy information for high-powered business travelers in search of brothels in Eastern Europe and Asia that specialized in child prostitution. She glanced at me, but I didn't say anything. The Boggs Institute dropped him like a hot Mr. Potato Head, but he got picked up by a consortium of import-export businesses that dealt with consumer goods. My hands tightened on the steering wheel. Has the ring of legitimacy. Until they started expanding into tanker ships and crude oil. They reported more than a few shipments light, and Lockhart was called on the carpet before the Securities and Exchange Commission and put on notice. He supposedly retired shortly after that. Free to pursue his other sordid interests? She sighed. There's also a little more on Gloss, but it doesn't seem like enough. What did you find? The only criminal activity on the guy is a censorship by the Texas Gas and Oil Conservation Commission concerning some work he was doing in Mexico. I guess he was subpoenaed and gave sealed testimony to the Texans before they gave him the boot and told him he could never do business in the Lone Star State again. Must have been something pretty bad. For Texans to not want to do business with you? No shit. She shuffled through the stack and then threw it onto the floor in the back. She was left holding only a single sheet of paper. There's information on all these guys, but just enough, never too much. I mean, a shitbird like Gloss, without a record? It just doesn't make sense. She placed an elbow on the sill and lodged a boot on my dash, something she always did when thinking troubling thoughts. The connecting points are the government and the petroleum industry. All of them have ties with one or both of these things. I shook my head. But why here? I mean, you can tell me they got religion, but it's gotta be oil, Walt. Doubletop says there's no oil around here, at least nothing worth drilling for. Have you checked that with anybody else? Hell, he said they can't give the teapot dome away. I eyed her with a sad little pit growing in the center of my stomach, as the whir of the tires on the pavement and the continued roar of the engine were the only sound. What exactly is that supposed to mean? I'm just saying, Double Tough was a project foreman for an entire coal bed methane operation down here, so I would assume that he's intimate with the geology of the entire area. Or? I stared at her and then returned my eyes to the road. Look, I know we're in the suspicion business, but you said a lot of money, Walt. A lot of money. She looked at the sheet of paper in her lap. He was in the energy industry. So we're just going to arrest everybody in southern Absaroka County who's worked in the energy industry? We better expand the jail. He's ex-military, too. She read from the paper. Even had a few fingers in Venezuela and Bolivia. Sound familiar? She studied the side of my face. He never put any of that in his application or job history, nothing. You're saying he's in on it? So, what, he set fire to himself? I knew this was how you were going to react, and I wasn't even sure I was going to tell you until I had more to go on. She turned her face and looked south, and we listened to the 10 cylinders pulling us along at 100 miles an hour. When's the last time you heard from Freimeyer? I looked at the back of her head, a little confused by the turn of conversation. The last time I dropped off checks, about 2 weeks ago. Nothing since?
No.
Don't you find it funny that nobody's heard from him except Double Tough? And the word from him is that Chuck is hitting the road with the fiancée, that no one has met, and moving it all, lock, stock, and star, to an undisclosed location in Colorado?
I took a deep breath and then snorted at the thought. Look, we've both been going without sleep, but that's just crazy.
Maybe.
She unlodged her boot and turned in the seat to look at me.
I hope I'm wrong. I'm praying that I'm wrong, but I'd feel a lot better if we made a run over to the house they rent and talked to Freimeyer. How about you?
I didn't say anything, and kept driving. Cesar Vittoria's unit was parked in the lot beside the Suburban, and he and Henry, drinking coffee in cups from the Sinclair station by the highway, were standing, studying the debris inside the burned-out husk of the Quonset hut. As we pulled up, the Basco came to my window.
Hey, boss, has Ruby been trying to get hold of you?
Yep. You?
Yeah, I answered, and then some pompous asshole got on and wanted to know where you were.
What'd you say?
Started beating the mic on the dash and telling them that they were breaking up and that I'd call back when I got in range.
Now I know all your secrets.
You bet.
He looked around at the wreckage, pulled a hand up, and cinched it on his Beretta in reaction.
Somebody definitely set that fire. You can see from the scoring on the chart that it burned hottest at the beginning.
I took his coffee and had a sip myself.
Where'd you learn such things?
Freimeyer, remember? He was the fire investigation guy over in Sheridan.
I could feel my undersheriff's eyes boring into the back of my head. The Cheyenne Nation's voice was low.
What is the plan, assuming we have one?
These guys don't like the heat, so they're going to call in the lawyers and piss on the fire. I can't have that.
They both nodded, and I looked at Victoria Moretti, who was studying us with her Browning tactical boot back on my dash.
But first I need to make a quick stop. None of us knew where the house was, and we couldn't call into the office without alerting the gaggle of lawyers to our whereabouts, so the Cheyenne Nation had a brainstorm and looked in the phone book. The house was down by the middle fork of the Powder River, set back in some Russian olive trees and red willow. Two-story and large for the area, it probably had been built as a ranch headquarters 75 years ago. But as the town had crowded in, the ranch had up and left. The clapboard was covered in a black spray of mold where the overgrown trees rested on the surface. Overall, the impression was one of decay, just the kind of place where two bachelors might live.
It's the house of Usher.
There was a late-model Chevrolet parked in the driveway, with plates that read Fry, which led us to believe that there was no reason to call first. The only disturbing thing was that the driver's side door hung open. I parked in front of the bridge at the edge of the high grass. They need a lawnmower. We got out and walked to the driveway. Vic went to the overloaded mailbox and pulled out a handful of assorted mail.
What they need is a wrecking ball.
Henry looked at the windows, empty except for the rebel flag hanging in the front. Still holding the shotgun, he took a few more steps forward and made his stand at the end of the driveway. Vic sifted through the mail, dividing it into two groups, as I joined her at the box. Anything?
The usual crap, but there are handwritten letters to Chuck from an address in Sheridan in a spirally script with little hearts dotting the eyes.
So the fiancée exists?
Apparently.
Anything else?
She stuffed the lot back into the mailbox. I swear it's only guys that get the Victoria's Secret catalog.
Cesar Vittoria joined us.
Would someone mind explaining to me what it is that we're supposed to be doing?
Vic growled. Social call.
The Basco looked at the Cheyenne Nation, still standing at the end of the driveway with the scattergun.
You bet.
We all joined the bear like the Bighorn Mountain Mod Squad.
Reservation warrant?
Henry was referring to the old method of planting somebody at the back door to yell, "Come in," as you banged on the front. No, we'll just knock, and if nobody answers, we go in. My undersheriff frowned as she checked her Glock.
Inadmissible. We find a body in there, then we need this to be by the book.
Sancho interrupted.
A body?
I glanced at Henry, knowing well his habit of squirreling away ammunition. Do you still have some of those extra shells in your pockets?
I do.
Cesar Vittoria wasn't going to let it go.
What body?
Didn't Freimeyer say something about needing more 12-gauge ammo?
The bear nodded. I believe he did.
Whose body?
Henry turned and regarded the young man.
What body? Whose body? Is life really worth so many questions? Let us just go down there and shoot or be shot, shall we?
We watched as he blithely flipped the shotgun onto his shoulder, as if it were a parasol in a fancy dress competition, and paraded down the grass strip between the two gravel tracks in his worn moccasins as if it were a garden path. Sunday in the park with Bear. The Basco glanced at me and pulled out his own sidearm as we started after the Cheyenne Nation. How did we win?
I shook my head. I'm not so sure we have.
I paused at the vehicle and peered inside, but there was nothing out of the ordinary. No blood, not even keys. Pushing the door shut, I looked at the house. The storm door, which had the glass busted out, was open, along with the main door, even more disturbing. The front porch was a little rickety, and more than a few boards gave way as I took the point position. I stuck to my plan and knocked, loud and clear. I waited, but there was no answer. Henry reached over and gently pushed it the rest of the way open to reveal a living room. There was a large, flat-screen television on a stand in front of the curtained front window with a number of devices attached to it with cables and what looked like plastic guns. Vic moved past me and knelt down to look at the stack of cartridge covers. Looks like the boys are gamers. Henry fanned out to the entryway that appeared as if it led to an abbreviated dining room as Sizer Vittoria and his Beretta moved past into the kitchen. I started getting the feeling that I should have my sidearm out, too. Vic stood and looked around at the art held against the walls with thumbtacks. A few wildlife prints, posters from movies I'd never seen, and a silhouette target with the majority of his 11-point heart shot out. She shook her head. Men. I backtracked into the entry and followed the Bear as he stood looking up the steps to what I assumed were the bedrooms. I kept my voice low. Anything? He shook his head as Vic, also speaking quietly, joined me. If, and I repeat, if there is no one here, why was Double Tough sleeping at the substation? Maybe Freimeyer went to Sheridan and didn't tell him. I don't know. Sancho had taken the basement, and Henry nodded toward the stairs and started up with us following. There was a landing at the top with one of those pull-down attic accesses, doors on either side, both of which were closed, and a window that overlooked the backyard. We split the duty as we got to the top, the Bear taking one door and Vic and I taking the other. The door was stuck to the old paint on the molding, but I bumped it open and found a mattress and box springs on the floor, the sheets and pillows looking like they got a regular workout. In an attempt at interior decor, there were a few Wyoming game and fish posters on the wall and a large Turkish rug on the floor that looked out of place. The closet door hung open, and clothes and an assortment of hiking and hunting boots were spilling out onto the floor. As a token to Amour, a small lamp with a pair of red panties hung over the shade was sitting on a cardboard set of drawers. It was still on, and cast a pinkish glow on the cracked wall. Vic walked into the room and paused to read the label on the lingerie. Victoria's Secret, of course. I turned to look at the Bear, whose girth blocked most of the other doorway, his face turned toward the ceiling. Vic joined me in returning to the landing behind him, and I moved to his side as he took a step into the room. He slowly raised his hand and finally an index finger, touching one of the stained cracks in the ceiling. He picked up the crack until a chip fell away and something seeped from the plaster. He withdrew his hand and rubbed the thick substance between his thumb and forefinger, and his dark hair pivoted to reveal the powerful face as he held his fingers out for me to smell. No mistake about it. I watched as a drop fell onto the narrow pinewood floor, the drip sounding like the beginning of a soft rain. This room was also empty, with the exception of two folding chairs, a sleeping bag, and what appeared to be a broken transistor radio. Stepping around Vic and back onto the landing, I reached up and pulled the short cord, lowering the folding stairs, and flipped the bottom section down, placing the spring-loaded rails on the scuffed, worn floor. I put a foot on one of the treads to test if it would hold my weight, and then gripped the rails and started up. It was dark in the attic, but there was a string hanging within arm's reach, so I pulled it, immediately illuminating the rafters with no insulation. I backed down the steps and looked at the two of them,
Dead raccoon. Vic smiled. Natural causes? I glanced at Henry, but he was no longer paying attention.
I'd wash my hands if I were you.
Vic started down the steps, and I spoke in a low voice. I hope you're ashamed of yourself. She stopped and turned as Henry continued downward. Look, it was a perfectly reasonable line of inquiry, all right?
I was just joking.
She turned and started off again. Wasn't funny. There was a scream from downstairs, and I was pretty sure it wasn't the Cheyenne Nation. Vic leaped down the steps Glock first, and I even found my hand on my sidearm as I half leapt, half tumbled down the steps after her. There was a young woman standing in the entryway with a pizza box on the floor at her feet and the bear with a hand out in an attempt to quiet her. She screamed again when she saw us, but then placed a hand on her chest and leaned against the wall in an attempt to catch her breath. Vic holstered her weapon and looked back at me. The fiancé. Figuring it was my party by default and that I should welcome her to it, I stepped past Vic and Henry and stuck out a hand of my own. I'm really sorry about this. I'm Walt Longmire, Chuck's boss. Her hand stayed on her chest, and she breathed deeply, finally pulling some of the blondish brown hair away from her face. Grace Salinas. I smiled.
Hi, Grace.
I looked down at the box, leaking pepperoni and melted cheese.
Sorry about the pizza.
Oh, it was some promotion they were supposed to be having over at the Sinclair station. They called and said we'd won a free pizza and that we could come over and pick it up, but when I got there, I had to pay for it. Not much of a promotion. She smiled back, but then looked concerned. You're here about the shooting? Vic and the bear glanced at me, and I continued to look at her.
Shooting?
This morning, the raccoon?
The dead one in the attic?
I told him not to shoot it, but it was keeping us up at night. He killed it this morning. I figured you were here because of that.
Not precisely, but is Chuck around?
She glanced in the living room as if he should be there.
He's here somewhere. I just ran out to get the pizza.
She stooped and began scooping the pie back in the box. If he went back to bed,
I don't think so. We were just up there.
She stooped for the box and started past us toward the kitchen.
Well, he's got to be around here somewhere.
Sasa Vittoria was standing in front of the closed back door next to a table and chair. He leaned on the facing and smiled a stiff smile. The young woman considered him and then turned back to me.
Boy, the gang's all here. Really, is there something wrong?
Sancho widened his eyes in the brief instant we had before she'd turned back and looked at him. I, in turn, made strong eye contact with Vic. Excuse me, Grace. Her eyes returned to me.
Yes?
How about you accompany my undersheriff back out front for a moment? I've got some things I need to discuss with Sancho.
Sure.
She studied me for a while and then started off as Vic followed her out.
I just can't figure where he got to.
The Basco waited until he was sure she was gone, and then stepped back, opening the door behind him enough so that I could see Freimeyer, in a pair of boots and a bathrobe, lying in the backyard, with a shovel still in his hands. Chapter 14. Sizer Batoria, the low man on the totem pole, drew the duty, and I sent him to wait with Grace in her car until the Ferg and the Powder River EMTs arrived. Ferg would drive the distraught young woman home to Sheridan, and Sancho would stay with Freimeyer. The rest of us were kneeling beside my deputy's body and trying to piece together what had happened. He shot the raccoon, went down to dig a hole in the backyard, and somebody caught him out there. The Cheyenne Nation carefully lifted the flannel bathrobe, saturated with blood.
With a knife. A very large one, in the hands of someone who knows how to use it.
He released the robe, and we watched as it settled back against the dead man's body.
Between the second and third ribs, up and to the side. Professional.
I thought about the conversation I had had with Lockhart on the boardwalk in front of the noose, and about professionalism. But mostly I thought about Didarte and the knife that he'd stuck in the pole between Henry and me. The bear looked toward the stream where the assailant would have most likely set up observation.
He waited, watched the house, called, and when she went out for the pizza, he went in.
Vic continued for him.
and when he wasn't in the house, caught him digging a hole in the backyard. But why was the door of his truck left open? The front door, the back door? And why take the chance and leave her alive? I nodded toward the house.
She was supposed to find him.
Henry sighed.
And call you.
I watched as Vic's jaw set, the way it always did before the storm. This was a delaying tactic?
I stood. They're counting on this slowing us down enough so that they can clean up and get out of here, or at the least get the lawyers between them and us.
They didn't have a reason to kill Doubletough, but they had one to kill Freimeier? She stood. What makes you think they're not already done and gone? I pointed at Freimeier's body.
This.
So now what?
The Cheyenne Nation also stood. We go after them. The elongated canine tooth trapped part of her lower lip as she smiled at both of us.
Now we're talking.
We piled in my truck, and Vic flipped up the center console in order to sit in the middle to allow the bear to have her coveted shotgun seat. She stared at the dash as Henry slammed the door behind him, lodging the butt of the shotgun between his feet.
Something?
She nodded. Yeah.
You're not suspecting one of us now, are you?
She stared at the dash, still distracted.
I waited for a moment and then started the truck, spinning around on the other side of the bridge and flipping on my lights and siren as her hand came up.
Why try and kill Doubletough?
I rocketed down Powder Junction's main street, a smattering of traffic darting for the curbs so that I could pass.
We're not on that again, are we?
She made a sound and threatened me with the hand as I waited, glancing at Henry, the two of us at a loss.
Something he said.
Who?
Doubletough, what did he say about last night?
I made the turn onto 192 and headed southeast.
Nothing important. He said he didn't see or hear anything.
Before that, he said something about a traffic stop.
We were just passing the burnt wreckage when she slapped me in the chest.
Stop!
I hit the brakes.
What?
She gestured toward the X station.
Pull in here, pull in!
I did as she said and watched as she crawled over Henry, yanked the door open, and ran toward what was left of the structure. The bear turned to look at me.
What is this all about?
We watched as she passed the building and continued on toward the Suburban, still parked where we'd left it early this morning. Henry clutched the open door as I spun the wheel and pulled across the parking lot to follow her. When we got to the SUV, she had the passenger side door open and had dived onto the front seat, her legs sticking straight out of the open door. The Cheyenne Nation glanced at me as we got out.
It must be something important.
We stood there as she extricated herself from the Suburban, with Doubletough's duty clipboard in her hands, pulling the forms free of the clip and throwing them into the open cab.
Vic?
She ignored me and opened the inside of the clip, where the white copies were usually deposited to be filed. She stood there, looking at the top one, finally turning it around and handing it to me. The form was a standard ticket written out as a warning to one of the kids Doubletough had mentioned stopping yesterday evening. He was driving an early 70s C-10 pickup with South Dakota plates, and his name was Edmund Lanier. I raised my eyes to hers.
Eddie Lanier, late of Butte County, South Dakota?
I thought about it.
The kids.
I studied the form. What the hell were they doing over here last night?
She shook her head. I don't know, but they were here in that diarrhea-colored truck, and somebody got in there and took that bit. Either you were wrong about Lockhart being unconcerned about the damn thing, or someone else was interested.
When we reached the entrance to East Spring Ranch, the Scowers-colored truck was sitting on the other side of the gate with a gaggle of heavily rearmed teenagers in the bed, on the hood, and in the cab. I pulled my truck to the side of the road, still a little ways away from the gate, and left the engine running. I shut off the sirens, but allowed the blue lights to continue racing across the blockade like an accusation. Eddie Lanier was, of course, the first one to speak.
That's as far as you go.
Stepping from my truck, I watched as Henry, having left the shotgun behind, slid out the other side. Vic, who evidently had decided to hold back until this particular group of the youth of America made their move, remained in the bullet and watched. Henry joined me, and we walked toward the fence as I pulled the paper from my pocket and held it up for them all to see.
This is a warrant for admission to this property, and I will now ask you to move this vehicle and unlock this gate to grant us entry.
Eddie, who was holding some sort of tactical shotgun with a folding stock and built-in light, called down from the top of the cab.
We were told to kill you if you try and enter.
I looked up at the kid. Hey, Eddie, why don't you climb down here and talk to us?
The other four were now making menacing noises with their weapons like they were starring in an episode of Steadfast Resolution, beside the fact that these modern automatic armaments haven't had to be cocked since well before they were all born. I rolled up the warrant, for all the good it was doing me, and put it away. The light from the shotgun was bright, and I raised my hand to block the beam.
Before you do something stupid, how about we talk?
My only concern at this point was that they might accidentally discharge one of their exotic toys, and I knew from experience that accidentally dead was still dead.
I bet I can guess who it is that gave you these weapons.
He didn't say anything.
I'm betting it was that character, Tom Lockhart, wasn't it?
He still didn't say anything.
I bet he also filled your head up with a bunch of hooey about him being some kind of big wheel with the CIA, didn't he?
You could see the doubt beginning to chip away at the others, but Eddie was still standing tall before the man and wasn't giving ground.
He says you're dirty.
What?
He says you're planning on getting rid of us, that this is Armageddon.
He motioned with the barrel.
I'm not kidding, Sheriff. If you try to get past us, I'll kill you.
I shook my head. All right. First off, I'm here to tell you that Tom Lockhart is not CIA, FBI, Homeland Security, FEMA, NASA, the Absaroka County dog catcher, or any of the other things he's been telling you. He's just a loudmouth with a checkered past. Pretty much a never was. Now, I don't know if he got you guys to go after my deputy, Double Tough, and get the drill bit out of the Suburban. I don't know if you guys are the ones who set fire to the sheriff's substation as a diversion or what, but the important thing for you to know is that my deputy is still alive. I'd like to think that you didn't mean to hurt him or that you didn't even know that he was asleep in the back room.
The kid poked the shotgun at us with a little more enthusiasm.
Shut up! The point being that you haven't done anything that you're going to have to spend the rest of your life in an 8x8 cell paying for, unlike your buddy Tom Lockhart and his friends in there.
Eddie's face was red as he screamed down at me.
Shut up!
He gave you the guns and told you that was just the beginning, didn't he?
Said he'd cut you guys in on the deal? Well, I've got news for you. He's just a money-grubbing lowlife who's tricking all of you into doing his fighting for him.
Eddie jacked the breech of the tactical shotgun. Both Henry and I watched the spent, unfired shell bounce off the sheet metal of the cab and land at our feet. The bear looked at me. Neither of us all that concerned with Eddie Lanier. At that point, I heard a roar from behind us and figured Vic must have accidentally stepped on the accelerator in trying to get out of the truck, but I should have known better. The engine racing had been a warning, kind of like when a bull snorts, paws the ground, and bellows. When Henry and I turned to look at her, she had already reached up and pulled the selector in my truck down into gear. More readily able to tell the difference between a potential and absolute threat than I ever could, the Cheyenne Nation pushed me to the side with all his considerable strength and then leaped backward as the 3/4-ton charged forward into the giant gate. The bullet slapped the gate backward and in turn broadsided the truck on the other side. The young men, not unaccustomed to vehicular assault, leaped from their vehicle, leaving Eddie as the only occupant. Vic pushed the aged Chevrolet down the road sideways. Eddie dropped the shotgun in an attempt to stay on top of the truck, and Henry and I stood at the center of the road as Vic continued to push the entire mess like an icebreaker.
When do you think she will stop?
When she finds a cliff to push him off of.
I stooped and picked up the shotgun, noticing that it too was a Wilson.
Fancy. They must have a dealership.
Vic finally took her foot off the accelerator as she deposited the Chevy into the roadside ditch like some botched Macy's Thanksgiving Day float. One of the kids loped next to me, the others fell in, and pretty soon we looked like some lost platoon in search of transport. I reached down and took an elongated weapon from him.
Mind if I take a look at that, Edgar?
He smiled. Nope. I don't even know where the safety is, and it weighs a ton.
It doesn't have a safety.
Oh. He cantered along. It was the last one, and nobody wanted it. I mean, it's a bolt action. I held the exotic weapon up and looked at the barrel as we neared the two-truck pileup.
50 cal BMG.
He looked puzzled as we arrived at the bullet where the window was still rolled down. What's a BMG? Vic threw open the door, climbed out of my damaged vehicle, glanced at us momentarily as she slammed the door with more than a note of finality, and straightened her ball cap. "Big motherfucking gun," I clarified for the kid, "Browning machine gun." Lanier looked at the weapon with renewed respect. "It's a machine gun?" I studied the body of the thing, dark and dangerous. "It's an anti-material sniper rifle."
"Sniper, huh?"
"Yep."
"What's anti-material mean?"
The Cheyenne Nation offered as he came around the other side of the Chevy. "It shoots through walls."
"Wow."
Eddie Lanier was trying to climb out of the bed of the C-10 where he'd been deposited when the vehicle ditched, and Henry lowered the tailgate to make it easier on him as I surveyed the damage to the bullet, now steaming and draining vehicular fluids onto the roadway. Eddie was holding his head, where a substantial cut was bleeding through his fingers.
"You wrecked my truck again."
I surveyed the damage to the trucks and to Lanier. "Doesn't look like it did mine any good either." I patted the tailgate and had him sit, laying the shotgun and the Big 50 in the bed to keep company with the cases and extra ammunition that Lockhart must have left. Vic was in the process of taking the weapons away from the rest of them as Henry appeared at my side with a confiscated Armalite and the first aid kit from the bullet. I attempted to peel Eddie's hand away as the other teenagers gathered round, incapable of